This is an interview for the Youngstown State Oral History Program, May 15, 1980, with Mr. Robert Vestal. Subject is the history of the Erie Railroads. Okay, first of all, would you give me a little background information? Tell me about your family life and something about your childhood.
Well, I was born in Youngstown, Ohio on May 5, 1920. My father was Roy W. My mother was Martha B. Evans. I have three brothers and one sister. I am the second oldest in the family. I was of course born and raised mostly after 1920 during the worst part of the Depression. My dad was a bus driver and he managed to hang on to a job throughout the Depression. And I went to South High School and I participated in sports at the high school level. I played a lot of sandlot football. My main love is baseball. I participated in baseball until I was 48, but after I graduated from high school, I started out working at a grocery store as a delivery boy. I worked 70 hours for $10 a week.
Now, what is the name of this grocery store?
Solomon's Food Market. After that, I was there 1 year. I gave him an ultimatum that if I didn't get a raise, I was going to quit. So he gave me a $2 a week raise, so the next year I made $12 a week. And I then got a job at Republic Steel in the pipe mill at Center Street. I worked there for about, I'd say a year or so. I worked the third trick for $5 a day. And I then had a chance to work at another food market. And I finally dilly-dallied around and got them up to $40 a week. And I went to work for what they called the Quality Food Market right across from South High School. I also worked at Warner Theater. I was an usher. After a few months, I became the chief usher, or head usher, as you used to call them in those days. By the way, I also played the Hawaiian guitar, and when I was 15, I started to work for the National Hawaiian Conservatory of Music, which was in the old Erie P&LE Railroad station at Commerce and Phelps Street, which eventually is where I ended up working. But I did that until I graduated, and after I graduated, of course, so I didn't have the time to do that. Then this is how I managed to land a job on the Erie Railroad. I delivered groceries to a fellow by the name of Charles Terrell. And at that time, he was the chief clerk to the general manager of the Erie Railroad. And he asked me if I was going to drive truck all my life or if I had other ambitions. So he did tell me that if I was interested, he would keep me in mind. Well, I'd been told this by many, many people throughout my driving around to the various homes, and nothing ever happened, but Chuck was true to his word. And I'd say about 2 months after that, I got a phone call at work and asked if I could sneak downtown and get an interview, which I did. And I was interviewed by a man by the name of Johnson, and he was supervisor of stations at the time. So he asked me if I typed, and I said, well, I typed about 6 months in high school, but I hadn't typed for about 4 years. So he called a freight agent at Warren, Ohio, a man by the name of Frank England. And he said, I have a young fella here that I think might make you a pretty good clerk. So at the time, they didn't have any openings up there. So he said that perhaps he would hire me as a mail clerk messenger the following week, if I could pass a physical. And they used, at that time, they also gave you a test, a written test, in order to be hired. And you had to pass this test, or of course you weren't hired. So I managed to pass both of them, and I was hired on January 27, 1941, as mail clerk messenger in the division superintendent's office at $75 a month, 48 hours a week, 6 days a week, no overtime. And I worked there, then I went on to, I was there until my birthday. I remember that. The first move I made was on my birthday, May 5th, 1941, is when I transferred to work for Mr. England at Warren Freight Station. And when I was called back to Mr. Johnson's office and he talked to Mr. England, apparently Mr. England must have asked him if I could type. And apparently must have asked him if I was a good typist. And he says, oh my, he's a good typist. So, Julie, I went up to Warren. And I worked second trick. And they had the old-fashioned billing machines. And I had never seen a typewriter like that in my life. And it was all capital letters and numbers. So he brings over some bills and he sets them down beside me. And he brought me a couple to show me how to do them. And he says, you just follow along here and you read them off of here and put this more or less the same information. So I started by the hunt and peck method. And about 2 hours later, Mr. England came over and he stood by my shoulder and he says, you know, Mr. Johnson was right. And I said, how's that? He says, he was right. You're one hell of a typist. So that's how my career started. By the way, you might be interested to know that at that time we had three tricks at Warren Freight. We had about 22 clerks around the clock, that is counting everybody. We had a warehouse with a foreman, an assistant foreman, and about 10 men. And by the time I'd say about 15 years ago, they were down to four people. That's how the railroad changed over the years, but not to get ahead of my story. So then after I was there for a while, I handled various jobs up there. And then in around June of 42, I came back to the division superintendent's office, and I worked for the car distributor, a fellow by the name of Jerry Murphy, who's now retired. He ended up being my assistant later on. But then in October, of course, by that time we were in the war, and in October, I joined the United States Navy. I tried to get in the Air Force first, but I had a bad knee from baseball and they wouldn't take me. So I went in the U.S. Navy and I was one of the three highest people in the testing that they give. And as a result, myself and two other fellows were given an opportunity to choose any profession we wanted to undertake in the Navy. And I took signaling, visual signaling. And I went to Butler University for my studies for 6 months. And after getting out of there, I was sent to the West Coast. And I was on submarine chasers for a while. Then I came back to the West Coast. And I was put into the West Coast. And I did some training there. And I also was sent to Farragut, Idaho, in the middle of the mountains, believe it or not, at Lake Farragut, and it was called Camp Farragut, and there I became an instructor in signaling for about a year. Then I took special training, was sent to New Orleans for what they called DOC. It was, let's see if I can remember now what the heck they were called, floating docks, and they were built in sections. And very peculiar to this type of service because never been tried before, but they build them in sections, large enough to take the largest carrier that we might have in the service at the time. And they built 10 sections. And these sections were, as I said, built singly, and they were in the form and shape of a boat or a ship. It had a bow type and then a very square stern, and they had two wing walls, what they called wing walls, that laid down in the middle of the vessel, and those wing walls then were pumped up and set upright. They were then joined over, we went across the ocean to Guam, and there the 10 sections were put together, and then in Apra Harbor, Guam, is where we started to take the biggest carriers, our battleships, our carriers, destroyers would come in, and this saved us, the Navy, from sending them all the way back to San Francisco or to Hawaii to be repaired. And so I served out my time, most of it there, and I was in training then, finally, for the landing in Japan. I was to take an LST in when, thank gosh, the war ended.
What is an LST?
That's a landing craft. And you probably see them in the, where they drop the front end, like at the landing at Normandy and that. You've seen pictures, so I'm sure of that in World War II. And it was my job to pilot it in. And you'd go in to the point where you thought the drop-off was shallow enough that the men with all their paraphernalia could get off without drowning, and then you'd get the devil out of there. But as I say, fortunately the war ended. We didn't have to invade Japan. And then I was discharged in 46, came back to work at the Erie. I debated for a while as to whether to go to school or not. Then I decided that I would come back to the Erie, which I did. And I came back to the division superintendent's office in March of 46. I worked various jobs in the division superintendent's office until April 1st, 1958. At that time, I was appointed to the post of division chief clerk, and I remained in that post until the formation of the Consolidated Rail Corporation on April 1, 1976. Shortly thereafter, my title was changed to office supervisor. Check that. It was changed to administrative assistant. And then shortly thereafter, they changed it again to office supervisor for convenience purposes, as far as I know. And that's about my background as far as my service record goes. But some interesting points would be the fact that when I started on the railroad in 1941, we had six trains between Chicago and New York. We had three trains between Cleveland and Youngstown. We had a passenger train, two passenger trains round trip that consolidated with the P&LE Railroad here in Youngstown. In other words, you could get on Erie Railroad passenger train in Cleveland, you came to Youngstown, the Erie crew got off and the P&LE crew got on, and you could stay on the train and go right on into Pittsburgh and vice versa. And of course, as the years went by, and in those days, Julie, when I went to work at 7:30, quarter to 8, I had to fight my way through the first floor where the waiting rooms were, because you couldn't get up to the elevators. There were so many people. And at that time, in fact, I spent all my career at the division superintendent's office and so forth in that old Erie P&LE station building until we finally moved out of there with Conrail in February of 19, check that, in September of 1978. So all those years I spent there. At that time, they had ticket offices, of course. We had the fifth and sixth floors for our offices. The waiting room took up the entire first floor, with the exception of one end where they had a little restaurant. The basement was some more waiting room space, plus it was a complete barber shop, red cap offices down there. We had matrons around the clock, 24 hours a day, that did nothing more than take care of the women's restroom. And as I say, over the years that all dwindled down to nothing, till of course now, as of today, we have no passenger business at all.
Okay, now the Erie and P&LE station that you're talking about is the old terminal.
That is the old Erie terminal building. It's right at the corner of Commerce and Phelps. It's been there all these years, and at one time the ownership of that building kind of flip-flopped back and forth, but at one time a woman owned it, and she was going to tear it down, so the old Erie bought it. That time, I think we were the Erie Lackawanna. Somewhere in the 60s, Julie, and I'm not sure where, that's why I didn't say anything about it, the Erie was struggling somewhat, and the Delaware and Lackawanna on the East Coast was struggling, and it was decided in the interest of both that we would consolidate into one railroad. And so they started negotiating, and of course, if you've ever watched the mergers, it takes 2, 3, 4 years for a merger to go through. When we started, the Lackawanna was in pretty good financial shape, as was the Erie, although we were both struggling, and we knew, and we ran parallel to one another for hundreds of miles, so it was only natural to figure if we could just run on one railroad, we would save a lot of money via maintenance, et cetera. So this was the idea behind it. And so, but by the time all the paperwork got out of the way and the merger was set to go, the Lackawanna was in deep trouble. On top of that, we understood that they had given some terrific raises to all of their non-agreement personnel, so that when the merger finally took place, they had train masters making more money than our division superintendent did. And by the time the two railroads got together, it was a real struggle, because what we had left was practically dragged right down. And we went along pretty good until, I believe it was Hurricane Agnes came along, and that was what killed the Erie Railroad, the Erie Lackawanna at that time, because we suffered $10 million worth of damage to our bridges and to our track, and we didn't have the capital. We had been borrowing right along, and what we were doing as the cash came in, by law we had to have enough cash, if I remember correctly, and don't quote me, we had to have, the railroad itself, the system, had to have enough cash in the banks to cover, I think, two pay periods. And so we were just doing this, and then they were paying the bills from behind as they could with the cash they had. And consequently, of course, we had a lot of creditors who were screaming. So finally, this hurricane hit and just wiped, well, we didn't have the cash, so we had no choice. We had to go into bankruptcy again. And eventually then, of course, we went into Conrail, although for a long time, the Chessie system, that was the B&O and C&O who had merged, they were a going railroad, and they were interested in parts of our railroad. And in fact, it had gone so far that we'd even been interviewed by the Chessie. And I had been interviewed and was informed that I would move to Akron if the Chessie took us over, and I'd be the only one from this area to go. And I would go simply because of my knowledge of the operation of the Erie Lackawanna at the time. And then, of course, that fell through, and because Conrail took over Consolidated Rail Corporation. So that brings us up to about where we are now. We're located in the Hiawatha 1 building now. Probably the most beautiful offices I've ever worked in my life. I never had a carpet under my feet until 2 years ago. And of course, you know, relatives could tell you that too. But it is probably one of the nicest offices that most railroads have ever worked in. In fact, our people in Pittsburgh say that when they used to come down here, that they had to be the nicest office they'd ever seen. And they are pretty nice.
Okay, now before we go any further, could you give me a description of what you did as a division chief clerk? What were your responsibilities?
Well, my responsibilities, I was responsible, as I said before, and I don't think it's on the tape, third in command for the division, which meant that as division superintendent, he was responsible for all the departments on that particular division. We were responsible for all the yards. We were responsible for all the road trains. We were responsible for the stations, the freight stations, and so forth, right down the line. The master mechanic who would be in charge of the mechanical department for the repairing of cars and locomotives, etc. The division engineer who was in charge of the maintenance of our tracks and buildings and facilities. They all had to report to the division superintendent. So now my job was to coordinate all of these particular phases of railroading. I had complete charge of all the clerical forces on our entire division, which ran at that time from Meadville on the east to Kent, Ohio on the west, and then various branches, including the Cleveland branch, which went up to Cleveland, Ohio. I also would have had, we had charge of all of the personnel, both operating and non-operating. That would be conductors and enginemen and so forth, trainmen, enginemen, clerks, operators, and so forth. The division superintendent's office, everything that went on that division had to go through the division superintendent's office. So my job was, again, as I say, to coordinate all these things. All the mail crossed my desk at the time, and not only mine, but whoever happened to work the desk. And I had to answer all the correspondence. We had to take care of contracts, had to deal with sidetrack agreements. We took care of land sales. We wrote various agreements locally here, were sent to our legal department where they were looked at and sent back to us to handle to a conclusion. We handled all the employment records for every man, woman, and child that was on our railroad. From the 1800s on up, we had all the records here in the division superintendent's office. I did, as I said, all the hiring of the clerks. I was responsible to see that all the claims that were submitted, both for the operating people and the clerical forces and so forth, were handled. I handled all that correspondence. And then at the same time, I had a force of 16 in the division superintendent's office that I had direct authority over. And in that office, we had an assistant chief clerk. We had a clerk that took care of nothing but employment records and passes at that time were a big thing. We had a contract clerk who handled all the agreements. We had an accident clerk who handled all the accidents, derailments. We had a file clerk, naturally. We had three secretaries. We had what we call a report clerk. We had a mail clerk messenger. We had a car distributor. So really, the division, you might say, anything that came up, we handled. We had complete responsibility for running that division, no matter what it was. And so, put it in a nutshell, I guess you'd just handle everything from soup to nuts. And we were just responsible to run it in those days. Eventually, in 1963, our division was widened 209 miles from Meadville East all the way to Hornell, New York. And we consolidated the two divisions into one. And our division was known as the Mahoning Division. It retained that title after we consolidated, and I was appointed and kept on as division chief clerk at that time. And the fellow who had the same job in Salamanca, his job was abolished, and because of his age, he decided to stay there. He only had a couple years to go or something like that at the time. And so consequently, I was lucky and I hung on to my job. More or less, I've always said, not because I was any better, but because I just happened to be younger. And so that's how that happened. And I could tell you a little story about you and your grandfather here. When we consolidated the two divisions, we had a meeting in the division superintendent's office. And at that time, the vice president, who was a man by the name of Fred Digtell, came down. And they explained what was going to happen. And your grandfather and I were in there. And he says that certain individuals were going to get raises and so forth and so on. And your grandfather says, "Well, Mr. Digtell, what about Bob and I?" And Mr. Digtell says, "Well, Lloyd," he says, "you and Bob," he says, "I guess you're just going to get more work." You can ask your grandfather about that. So that's how that merger went. But like I say, I don't think it had anything to do with my ability any more than the fact that I was the younger of the two. And also, we were going to keep the main headquarters here in Youngstown. So it would only be natural then, I think, to keep the force that was here. And believe it or not, out of the entire force up in Salamanca, which was a big force, they only brought two clerks down to assist us in taking over the whole entire division. And so it was quite a challenge. And at that time, the general manager's office closed upstairs. We were known as the Western District at the time. And they moved lock, stock, and barrel. They wiped out the general manager level, and all those people were offered an opportunity to move to Cleveland, which most of them did. And those that didn't, of course, were given a chance to exercise their seniority, which they did too. So that takes you through that part. Now, what else you got?
How has your job changed under Conrail? Is it primarily the same job responsibilities?
No. I was promised that not to worry when we merged the, what we did is the old Penn Central had what they call the Valley Division with headquarters in the Stambaugh building here at Youngstown. We of course had the Mahoney Division of the old Erie, which was housed in the Erie building. And when it was decided to form one division out of the two, it was to be known as the Youngstown Division. And here again, this time the balance went against me because it was decided that the Penn Central superintendent, who at that time was Bob Hatton, would take over the responsibility for the new division, the new joint division, which would be the Youngstown Division. The superintendent over on the Erie, who was Bill Flight, became division superintendent in Altoona, Pennsylvania. Well, of course, our offices were wiped out, although two or three of the jobs were moved across the way, and we were to move into the Stambaugh building. And most of the departments were the same way. They abolished quite a few jobs, but they kept a few at the same time. So Mr. Hatton told me not to worry, that he would see that I was taken care of. And I have to admit that he did do this. And you've asked me the difference between what I do now and what I did then. They formed a little office. I took the secretary with me, and her and I became an office force for the assistant superintendent. And they then formed a new position called terminal superintendent. And they also had a position, division road foreman. So they put the secretary and I sort of in the middle of these three, and we became an office force for these three. But I guess what you would say is, again, I think because of my age at this time, that, as I said, the balance went the other way. The young fellow that was on the same type of job as I had on the Erie, it was his superintendent that took over. So naturally, he stayed on because he was familiar with his operation. And I was, as one person, well, the secretary told me, she says, "You're just like a blanket that's been put on a shelf." And that's exactly more or less what I've been. I have no responsibility. To put it bluntly, I'm probably no more than an accident clerk or a glorified clerk. Although my boss keeps telling me that I'm his office supervisor, but I don't have too much to supervise. But they did give us one more person here a couple of months ago. So now I have a secretary and this other lad and then myself. But truly, we more or less just work together. And no one, I don't try to give any authority too much whatever, because I feel we're all in the same boat. So. And I know that my job, I'm sure, was created, again, because I was the only one left after they after they transferred Mr. Flight. I was the only one left from the old Erie Lackawanna. I was familiar at all with the operations, the people, the clerks, the names, the yard masters, and so forth, and some of the operation. And so, in fact, the statement was made to me, "Hurry up and get over here because I need your knowledge of the old Erie Lackawanna." And so that's how my job came about. And like I say, I think the man was true to his word. He did save my job for me. And so that's where I am now.
Okay, were you ever a member of a union?
I'm a member of a union. I was a member of the Brotherhood of Railway and Airline, BRAC, Brotherhood of Railway and Airline Clerks. BRAC, it's known as. Mm-hmm. I belonged to that long before union shop came into effect on the railroads, voluntarily. And then when union shop came in, of course, we all had to join. When I was appointed to a non-agreement position in April 1958, I retained my membership in the BRAC for a number of years. And then when I was denied an opportunity to attend a meeting, I withdrew from the membership with an understanding that if and when I went back to a position that came under the union, I would then rejoin. Recently, the Conrail, or Consolidated Rail Corporation, made an agreement with the BRAC, and certain non-agreement positions, many of them high up on the railroad, were compelled to join the union with the understanding that this would retain our seniority rights, which, Julie, we had anyway, because they couldn't take our rights away from us, because the old agreements all said that when we were promoted to non-agreement positions, or positions not covered by contract, that we would be considered as being on leave of absence. And under that particular rule, which is a Rule 42 in the book, meant that whenever we came off of that job, we would then have the right to displace any junior employee under us that we would be entitled to with our seniority. Now, what we've done really, what Consolidated Rail has done, has just meant that we get no rights from the BRAC. We still get all the wage increases and so forth as given by the company to non-agreement employees. We get no benefits or privileges of the union, but it costs us the union dues, which right now are $23.20 a month. So theoretically, I'm paying about $240-$250 a month now for rights that I had anyway. But theoretically, that's what they did, and now I am also a bona fide member of the BRAC, even though I hold a non-agreement position, if you can figure that one out.
What are your opinion of the unions?
Well, they're good and bad, and I'll tell you this, without the unions, we'd never have the working conditions we have today. It's like anything else. If we didn't have the union, Julie, we wouldn't have anything. We'd be starving to death. We don't have the companies, then we wouldn't have any jobs. And it's one of those deals where both sides are good and bad, because there's never never a middle. It seems as though, and this is a good time now with inflation the way it is, if it wasn't for the unions battling the way they do, me, even before I was forced to join the union under this new agreement, which was only come in since last July, I wouldn't get any wage increases. That is, we as non-agreement personnel or supervisory personnel would not get any wage increases at all, because the only reason we get them is because contract people get them. And if they're going to keep their supervisors, then they've got to grant us some. Now, we never get as much as the contract people get. Mostly what happens, your contracts are for 3 years, and usually about every 6 months, 1st of January, 1st of July, they get a raise. For instance, they got a big raise coming up here, not so much percentage-wise, 5%, but they also have the cost of living tied into that, which will be a huge amount, probably 20-30 cents an hour, maybe more than that, on top of this 5%. Now, we get one raise a year, normally, and it's what they call a merit increase, and your dad probably told you about that. And what happens there is, each supervisor is judged once a year on his abilities on the position that he holds. And you can get any, they have various, what they call various steps. And if you can be marginal or unsatisfactory, you can be doing a satisfactory job, a superior job, or an outstanding. They figure 75% of your personnel are satisfactory. There's about 15, maybe 20% that are superior, and only about 5% that are considered outstanding. And then your percentages are based on what where you're put, whether it's satisfactory or so forth. Then they also have in that, they also have three steps. You have a minimum salary range, you have a middle salary range and you have a maximum on that particular job, what they call a train master's job. Depending on the location, the size of the job, or your responsibility, they also give what you call points. So for instance, you might have a train master's job in Youngstown with 594 points. I might be the train master in Sharon over here with only 490 points. So consequently, my wage, my opportunity to get to a certain level is less than this guy because his is going to be rated higher, see? And that's how you're done. Now, if you're in the first table between the low minimum wage and the middle wage, you can fluctuate in there and get 10, 15, 20% depending on what it is. But you only get one increase a year. And I would say they probably average, if you take them all in, 10%. And inflation's running a lot higher than that. So, but this year the company has done something which I haven't seen a railroad do in a number of years. The 1st of January, they gave every non-agreement man the same increase, flat out, $100 a month to help us with inflation. This was over and above the merit increases that any of us got last year and whatever we get this year. See. So that is one thing that the company did do this year, which in all my years on the railroad, I've never seen it happen before. And but they did come out with a flat raise. Normally, it's if they even give you anything, it's usually and normally is a percentage. But they felt that if they gave, say, a 5%, here's a man with 20,000 a year at 5%, well, it costs him just as much to live as a guy that's making $35,000, but at 5%, he's going to get a lot bigger increase than the guy at 20% or 20,000. So they decided to give a flat rate, so everybody got the same. From the top man all the way down, they got $100 a month. And as I say, I've never seen that happen. And by the way, if you want something interesting, I've completed 39 years, and I have never lost a day's pay. I have never seen a day go by that I didn't get paid. And I don't think there's many people can say that in any kind of a company anywhere. I was off for one operation, but the company paid me. And I was off one day on account of a strike, but they called me out at 10 o'clock that night, the same night, and I wasn't supposed to be there, but the superintendent called me out. It took 6 months. And I thought that I finally had a day when I wasn't going to get paid, but after about 6 months, Bill Flight, was it? No, it was Carl Dingell. Carl Dingell fought and fought and fought, and I finally got my day's pay, and so I can truthfully say I've never lost a day's pay. Of course, I was in the service. I wasn't working, so I didn't get paid, but I meant while I was with the railroad, I've never lost a day's pay. Well, that's kind of nice over the years when you think of all the strikes and everything. You may not make the biggest money in the world, but I've known what I'm going to make, and that really helps.
So in your opinion, then, unions helped?
Absolutely. We'd be nowhere without them. And as I said before, naturally they do wrong things, but then so does the companies. And you got to have them to balance one another out. And sometimes a union goes too far, and sometimes the companies go too far. For instance, the company might ask, or the union might ask for a 10% wage increase, and when the company makes their counteroffer, they'll want to cut your wages 20%, do away with all the overtime, make you work 48 hours for 40 hours pay, all kind of ridiculous things. And so one's just as bad as the other when it comes to negotiating. What always seems strange to me is they go on strike, nobody can agree, but after they go on strike for a while, it seems like they can always sit down eventually and iron it out, and 90% of the time, it's exactly what it was in the first place between the two, maybe a penny or two difference, and so all you've done, the people have lost all this money, which they never get back, although you can't explain this to anybody. They think because they get a 5 cent an hour raise, they're gonna get, you know, rich, but they're never gonna get the money back they've lost. Mm-hmm. So, it's a vicious circle, but I'll tell you, we need the unions and we need need them. We have to have them protect us, absolutely. Whether we're non-agreement or agreement, doesn't make any difference.
Okay. Let me ask you your opinion of the competing railroads that the Erie competed against when it was just the Erie or the Erie-Lackawanna rather than Consolidated Rail Corporation now. What is your opinion of the Eastern railroads it competed with?
Well, that's a tough question because, as you probably know, the railroads are tied down rate-wise by the ICC. There's so many things that an individual railroad cannot do. So really, what you're talking about is service. If your railroad can provide better service than the Baltimore and Ohio, going to that same location, for instance, where numerous railroads sometimes do all go to certain places, then you're going to hang on to the business. So it's like any other competing company where you compete with other companies. In our business, it's nothing more than service. If you don't provide service, you don't get the business. It's just that simple. So consequently, it depends a lot on your salespeople. Then if the salespeople can sell some company the fact that our company will provide better service for your company than another railroad, another competing railroad, and you get the business, then it's up to you, your operating department, to see that the trains move on schedule, and they do move the freight. And that's the only thing you have to offer, Julie, is service. And so I don't care what railroads. Now, here in Youngstown, we competed in the olden days. We competed with the P&LE, the LE&E, the Youngstown and Southern, the Penn Central, the B&O. Did I say the P&LE? I think I did. But we competed with all those railroads. And when you get out of Youngstown, of course, then like toward Cleveland, we ran into the NW and the CNO and so forth. In Akron, we ran into the NKP or the Nickel Plate. Again, the NW, the B&O also went into Akron. And so consequently, you're just trying to provide better service, faster service. You can't do it any cheaper because you all have the same rates, you see. So it really is nothing more than service. That's all you had to do. And so consequently, we, as the Erie Railroad, the one thing that was in our favor was the fact that we could handle higher and wider loads than any other railroad in this area. Our line was so constructed that we could say what they call high and wides and deliver them all over the country and get them to other railroads where the B&O couldn't handle them, for instance, or the Pennsylvania at that time couldn't handle them. New York Central couldn't, and eventually, of course, it became the Penn Central, but they couldn't handle them either. So these big loads, for instance, that come out of Westinghouse, these big transformers, we used to get them all. And we were known as we served the heart of the industrial America, the heart of industrial America, and that was us. And we ran from the East Coast to Chicago, and that's as far as we went.
Okay, while we're on the topic of federal government, and you mentioned the ICC, mm-hmm. What is your opinion of federal regulations of the railroads? Has it helped or hindered them?
No, it would definitely have to hinder. It'd have to hinder because I feel this way, this is America, and in order for railroads to compete with other forms of transportation, and I'm not going against the truckers because they're held down the same way we are, but at the same time we ought to be free to compete. If we want to offer a company that we're going to haul their freight to Cleveland for $2.40 a ton, whereas the B&O is charging $3 a ton, we ought to be able to do it. And I think it would have been a great thing for the railroads. I think if we'd have had open competition, that we wouldn't have had all the bankruptcies we've got. Because over the years, when the railroads weren't making money, what they had to do, and I know our railroad did, we all owned railroad cars. when they needed heavy repairs, we didn't have the cash to do it. So we set them along on what we call storage tracks, and we just stored them. And so what happens then is we didn't have enough of our own cars, so we start using the cars of our competing railroads. And this was true of all of us. And of course, when you use the other railroad's cars, then we have to pay what we call per diem on them. And so consequently, we ended up, normally you try to balance this. You try to figure that there's so many of our cars over on the B&O, for instance, and there's so many of their cars over here, and we kind of balance one another out in order, if we're going to make money. Well, eventually, it got so bad that 90% of the cars we were using were foreign railroad cars, which meant we were paying per diem, and we didn't own any of these cars, and it was costing us a fortune. We might get the load, but at the same time, it was costing us a fortune because what we were actually doing was renting cars of another railroad. And so then eventually, when we got a new president finally, the first thing he did was got busy. Yeah, I jumped a foot. So then we tried to get more system cars again, what we call system, which is the owning railroad. And by that, if we can do that, then again, we start to balance out so that, or maybe even we use less of their car and they're using more of ours. So instead of us paying them, they start paying us. And although really and truly the Erie, after a few years, we never had the ownership of the number of cars that would allow us to actually let them use more of our cars than we were using theirs, because eventually we were practically using all per diem cars, and very few Erie Lackawanna cars were around. And so that was one reason, I think, why when Consolidated Rail came into effect, that the Penn Central more or less was the reigning railroad, because of course they own more than anybody. And so it only made sense, if you're going to change over to a certain type of railroading, then the most economical way would be to go to the biggest. Because if we'd have went, say, they wanted to decide to do everything the old Erie way, just think that we could fit in one little corner of the former Penn Central Railroad. So it meant just a tremendous amount of changeover the other way, where we could take the other five railroads and change them over to the Penn Central way a heck of a lot cheaper than to do it the opposite. And I think this is another reason why we just ended up with more or less Penn Central people in the general manager's positions and so forth.
Okay, what is your opinion of Western railroads? Why have they been so successful?
Because they have long haul, Julie. It's just that what we call long haul means that you get a carload of freight or a ton of freight, and you haul it from San Francisco to St. Louis, or you haul it from San Francisco or L.A. all the way to Chicago. You see, they didn't have all the industrial states that we do on the East Coast, so consequently, we did not have what we call long haul. That is, as long. It is nowhere near as far from New York to Chicago as it is from Chicago to the West Coast. So to make it simple, it's just the fact that they had the opportunity of long haul. On top of that, I think that they were a little better managed. But of course, this is hard to say, because they would have had a little better financial record, I think, than the East Coast railroads. And another thing, I think that if you will recall and you look over the maps, you'll find out there's not near as many major railroads doing that long haul as there were here in the East, especially the northeastern part of the United States. You can just name, well, you can just start, and you couldn't begin to name all the railroads that compete against one another here in the northeastern part of the United States. You have a few southern railroads that do very well, again, because they run all the way from the Gulf of Mexico all the way to Chicago or up into our sections up here. So they do have that long haul. The L&N is a good railroad. The Southern is a fine railroad. It's making money and has made money for years. Why? I don't know. They have a tremendous maintenance program. They have a good car repair program. I think here, again, the question is their management better? Or do they know something that we don't know up here in the northeastern part of the United States? But I can't believe that the northeastern railroads all went bankrupt because they were all managed badly. It doesn't make sense that everybody's going to be bad. I think it was just strictly the fact it was too much competition, too much federal regulation, and when the going got rough, wasn't any way we could offer a service cheaper to try to hang on to what we had or so forth. When our cars got so bad or our engines got so bad, they broke down, caused railroad delays, transit time, then naturally they went to a railroad that maybe would give them better service, and we gradually lost our service or our customers, and we lost them perhaps like to the Chessie, for instance, who was a good railroad, still is a good railroad. N&W is a good railroad. And another thing that we don't have anymore, and we used to have, is coal. And coal is a going product. In other words, you make money hauling coal, and that's why the N&W and Chessie do so well. They do have the coal. Now, the old Erie had the ore. And when we hauled the ore during ore season, we made money. The trouble was that the ore doesn't run in the winter. And so consequently, why it wasn't a year-long affair. And so in the winter months, then we struggled because we didn't have all this ore coming our way. And so naturally, we didn't make as much money.
Okay. In your opinion, what was the reason for the demise of the passenger service on the Erie Railroad? Why did it just die out?
Well, there are a number of reasons. Foremost, of course, I think, were the construction of your major highways. Made it so much easier to get back and forth to our major cities. A good point there would be Cleveland, how much easier it is now to travel to Cleveland than it was to go 422 and battle your way through every little town to get up there. And number two, of course, would have been the planes. Air flight is much faster, and although sometimes on a short haul it isn't, because the time you drive to the airport for 30 minutes and get a plane and then get out of the airport in Cleveland, got to get back to downtown Cleveland, you maybe haven't saved too much. But you go a little further, and there's no doubt that the airplane has hurt. Did hurt the railroads at that time. Another reason would be the fact that on our railroad, I don't know how the rest of the railroads were, but on our railroad, we lost money. You couldn't make money. Now, one of the major factors that caused the demise of the passenger trains was because the United States government post office took the mail away from us. Yeah, but when you were a child, you can remember that we used to haul the mail, and this is what kept the passenger trains in business. Passengers never could make us money. We had to have the mail, and when they took the mail away from us, that was the downfall, because then we didn't have the money to put into the passenger cars to keep it up. And once we start losing money, we decided it was cheaper to get out. And the last two trains we ran were the commuter trains between Cleveland and Youngstown. And Julie, we were losing $500 a day. And you can't operate and lose. And what happened there, naturally, was we not only didn't have too many passengers, I think we had one get on here at Youngstown, and that was what we call a deadhead. It would be a company employee that was deadheading to Cleveland to work in the general offices of the railroad company. And when you got past the first, like from Youngstown to Niles to Warren, probably didn't have 10 passengers get on. They got on after you got west of Warren in those little towns just outside of Cleveland. Again, 75-80% were what we call deadheads going to work in Cleveland for the railroad. So without the mail, it was the mail really, I think, if I had to pinpoint one thing, I would say number one was the mail. Number two would be the highways, and number three would be the air.
Okay. In your opinion, do you think that railroads in the Northeast will become important again? Or have they lost their importance and won't be able to pull themselves together.
In my opinion, right now, the biggest railroad, of course, is Consolidated Rail Corporation, or Conrail. And as far as I'm concerned, Julie, it'll never make money. It'll never make a go. It's too big. What we need and should have done at the time they formed Conrail, they should have made a couple of competing railroads against one another. In other words, they should have cut down the Penn Central to begin with and taken the other railroads and formed two railroads out of them, which was one of the plans, but no one would pay any attention to it. And they just went ahead, and as far as I'm concerned, railroaded Congress and everybody else into this one huge giant. And I don't think Consolidated will ever make it, never. And eventually what's going to happen to it is going to get cut up, and it's going to be bought in pieces by the other railroads, such as the Chesapeake, for instance, like I've said before, the N&W perhaps. And it'll all depend on what railroads are operating in the territories that we're talking about. Now, you know, Conrail runs all the way from the East Coast and up the East Coast all the way to St. Louis, and then branches in between, you know, north and south. And so consequently, you're competing against a lot of railroads. The N&W could take part of us. The Southern could probably take part of us. Chesapeake could take part of us. P&LE could take part of us. Now, when we get out further east, I don't even know what's over there anymore. We got most of it in that northeastern part when you get out into the Pennsylvania and up into New York. And maybe there'd be a piece of Conrail left in there some way to operate. But in my opinion, Consolidated will never make it.
Okay. Looking back, what changes, if any, would you like to have seen made that could have maybe saved the Erie Railroad from what's happened to it today? Would it have been this consolidation that they went through with Conrail?
I think that where the mistake was made, I think that the Erie Railroad, or Erie Lackawanna at that time, we were known, after the hurricane, which meant we had to have $10 million cash, I feel that if they would have taken our railroad and granted us, say, a $25 million loan and subsidized us the way they're subsidizing Conrail, millions and millions and millions and millions, we needed about 1/20 of what they're pouring into Conrail. In fact, I don't think we'd need 1/20, probably 1/50 of what they're doing. And we could have operated, and I think with a smaller railroad and good management, we'd have made it. And I think that's what should have been done with all the smaller railroads, and they should have broken up the huge Penn Central and sold it off to all the smaller railroads, along with the Chesapeake and the N&W, who were making money, and they'd have been further ahead, and I think you'd see a much, much better railroad segment here in the northeastern part of the United States, and then throw out the ICC regulations so that they can compete on a free and equal basis. If I want to haul your freight for 50 cents, that's up to me. And I think those two things, if they would have taken each of the railroads, even if they wanted to put somebody in there as the head of each railroad to kind of watch over, okay, if the government was going to pour some money in, I think you'd have seen a much better railroad operation than you're seeing today.
Okay, on a whole, looking at all the railroads throughout the country, what do you see for the future of railroading in this country? Will it become important to this nation again?
Well, Julie, let's put it this way. You could line up all the trucks in this country, bumper to bumper, and they couldn't begin to move the freight that one railroad could move. So whether anyone thinks the railroads are important or not isn't the question. They just have to be important. And if our country is going to sit back and let the railroads just go their own way until they just end up with nothing, I feel for this country if we ever get to a point where we have another war. we'll never be able to move the freight that we're going to have to move. One freight train can just, when you figure that we can move as high as 150 carloads of freight, there's no way trucks are going to handle that freight. That's just one train. And when you stop to figure the millions of railroad cars that move every day, they got to be important. If somebody don't see the light pretty soon, why, I don't know what will happen to the future. But the railroads have to be in the future, because there's no way you can move food or anything fast enough to feed the millions of people. It just has to be that they have to recognize the importance of the railroads. And someone will have to figure out whether we're going to spend money on road beds or go to different type of engines, or what we need anyway to compete. This is what we're going to have to do. But they're going to have to keep the railroads, and I don't know whether it's going to be you and I as the government. We hate to see the government get any more, but here they are sinking money into Chrysler, millions and billions, and they poured billions into Conrail. And like I say, if they'd have turned around and put a few million in some of these five railroads that we're talking about, like the New Haven and the Lehigh Valley and the Erie, we'd have been much better ahead, I think. But the railroads are the backbone of industrial America, and they're never going to get away from them. They're going to have to do something to make certain that they stay in operation. And like I say, I don't know how, I'm not that brilliant, but somehow they're going to have to figure out a way.
Okay, is there anything that I maybe forgot to ask you that you might want to add?
I don't know, I've rolled it all off a lot.
Okay, thank you for the interview.
Oh, you're entirely welcome.